Darkness, and I am on the way to hell. What is this thing? Leave me alone!
We'll do it live! Fuck it! Do it live! I'll write it and we'll do it live! F***ing thing sucks!
Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneeb is brilliant and R. Paul Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. A tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
Of history here on WBAI New York. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. We turn very rapidly to Gene Shepherd. I haven't heard it, don't know what it is. Well, but it's appropriate. Labor Day picnic, or Labor Day parade in Chicago, September 2nd, 1963. Let's get to it before we run out of time. This is the Dustbin of History, WBAI New York.
Thank you. I've got a cold, and that's officially now, it's official notice that the year has begun. As a matter of fact, you have ever had the feeling that Labor Day begins the year? That any other foolish designations like the first of the year, Christmas, all these things are not really real. That actually the year begins now, and all the rottenness starts. Trouble, trial, tribulation, fistfights. Are you aware that almost all the big military planners always look for the fall, for the big push? They don't. You know, they do. That's a fact, you know. I remember Colonel General von Rundstedt in the big push in December 19-something. But nevertheless, I do have a sneaking suspicion now that among all of us coming back, you know, from New Year's and all that stuff, we know that that's not the beginning of the year. And I think there must be millions of people now coming back from the big holiday who have the sense, well, all right, now let's go. I know that this is true in the theater. It certainly is true in this business. And I was watching the parade today, and I wonder whether or not I should tonight tell a story about how Labor Day parades are in a mill town. They're very different than they are in New York, I'll tell you that. A Labor Day parade in New York is really just, you know, just like any one of 1,000 parades that happen here in this town. Almost every week we have some kind of a parade with a bunch of guys with signs and banners and stuff. But a Labor Day parade in a mill town is a very different kettle of fish, let me tell you. Excuse the cliche, but it really, in many cases, even involved a kettle of fish. A Labor Day parade was a fantastic thing. And sitting here and as talking to you as one who probably has as large a portfolio of union cards in his pocket as anyone you've ever heard of, I belong, let's see now, right now at count, let's see now, I'll start right out. I belong to AFTRA, Equity, SAG, AF of M, AGVA. That's a pretty good collection right there. But then I have some other much more exotic ones. For example, I belong to CIO Steelworkers of America, Local 1010. And I have an active card there. I keep sending them my money because you never know, you know. I don't want to get those guys on my neck, I'll tell you. Well, you know, we used to have a little thing called stamp inspection. Now, I don't know whether you know about that. Stamp inspection is when you pay your dues, they give you a stamp and they put it in a little book. It's like one of these plaid books, you know, like one of these King Korn books of stamps, except that it was a little different. If you show up at the A&P and you don't collect King Cullen stamps, they just think you're a nut. That's right. Well, you've got the same thing. You know how it is. Have you ever tried that one? That's the ultimate today of nonconformity, is to go through the checkout line and say, no, I don't collect those rotten things. And they look at you like you're a nut all up and down the line. Everybody starts jumping and grabbing, thinking they're getting something free, of course, you know. But they had what they called stamp inspection. And stamp inspection was literally that, when you paid your due, except you didn't pay your dues. They took it away from you. You never, that was another thing too. And they would give you this, and they'd give you a little stamp, and they'd put it in your book. And then one day, just out of the blue, they're all standing around, a bunch of guys are standing around out in front of the mill, and you gotta show them your book with a stamp in it. And if you don't have a book with a stamp in it, they knock your head against another guy's head. They save guys, they pair them off, you see. They save guys that don't have stamps, you know, until they get two of them. Then they knock their heads together. And then they get three or four of them, then they get a sort of a castanet effect. And you'd be surprised how quickly you start buying stamps. I became a hell of a stamp collector. Excuse the expression, but I did collect a lot of stamps. I've got my book pretty well up to date. And so I don't know whether or not tonight would be apropos to tell you the story of a Labor Day parade in a mill town where they have real mills and they really have laborers. I mean laborers. And the strange atmosphere that exists. Well, all right, I might as well tell you then. You see, when Labor Day would get ready to go, they had Labor Day at different times of the year out there. They'd have them almost like spontaneous combustion. They would have a Labor Day, and everybody would march and hit everybody else and start burning down the plant and stuff. But that was another story. When they had official Labor Day, there was a lot of acrimony to begin with. The labor guys were not so much concerned with competing with floats. you know, and Miss Plummer's local 2238 sitting on the top of a big, you know, big plunger made out of paper and all kinds of little bunting and stuff. It wasn't quite like that in those days. A whole bunch of guys would walk down the street, and some guys would be carrying wrenches. Other guys would be carrying crowbars. And one guy would be carrying a big sign. It would say, CIO Steelworkers 1010. With a big exclamation point at the end. Like, anyone want to make anything of it? And they walk down the street, you know, and they look around the sidelines to see whether anybody's going to start throwing bricks at them. Well, invariably, after about the first three or four blocks, someone would start throwing bricks. This guy is in the Electrical Workers Union, see, or something like that, you see, where they were having a little trouble at the plant. One way, you know, who was going to be in charge of the water cooler? Who was going to be in charge of the ditto machines? Whether it was going to be the CIO steel workers or the electrical workers, electrical machines. So next thing you know, they'd be throwing rocks. Well, it was always a good day, I'll tell you. Anybody who, almost all of us, you know, have deep-seated aggressions that are way down deep in the heart of our soul, and we take it out bowling now, you know. We take it out writing rotten letters to the TV guide, that kind of stuff, you know, really aggressive. But the people of that period, since they were all laborers, took their aggressions out on Labor Day. And it was a beautiful moment. They were going to training about two or three weeks beforehand. Oh yes, they'd plan. I'll tell you the truth. They would plan how they would march. For example, the steelworkers would put the little guys in the middle. There would be a lot of little guys that were steelworkers, you know, little guys that worked cranes and stuff. But then there were big guys that just carried stuff around the plant. And guys, you know, the big things with hammers and stuff, they would form. It was like the old, you remember the old British technique in the army? The British had a famous, what was that thing called, a square? Yeah, the hollow square. Well, they had a hollow square all the time, and around the outside would be the tough guys. Now, they would be put, it was always very dangerous as to what part of the line of march a certain union was put. For example, if you put the steel workers, Local 1010, in the line, and they were right behind the IBEW Local 722D, and there was a big hassle going on in the coal strip between those two unions, and they were right behind one another. It was the most fantastic parade you ever saw. It consisted of a constant war of attrition down the street, yelling, hollering, until finally they would get opposite one or the other's union hall, and it would bust out. Actual bricks would go, and there was never a parade. This has to be pointed out. Hardly ever a parade was ever marched where there were things like drum majors, that kind of stuff. If they were there, they wore hard helmets. You know, the kind of helmets that you see these construction workers. Everyone went to the parade wearing his steel safety shoes. They did. That's the truth. I remember. And you were drafted, you know. Nobody was given the right to either say, I'm going to the parade or I'm not going to the parade. It was something like they must have done during the war, you know. You hear about the Nazis when they would take one out of every 10 guys and shoot them in the town. Well, that's the way it was in about marching. One out of every 10 guys in every given squad was pulled out. You're going to march. And all the other guys would hide in the crowd then. Their object was to hide in the crowd along the line of march, and when trouble broke out with the spectators who were, say, behind the, let's say, the electrical workers or the plumbers or the iron workers or the structural steel workers, you see, you would see there would be ringers in the crowd. Next thing you know, the crowd is fist fighting it out, and the plumbers band starts yelling at the structural steel workers band, and you can see these tubas banging into one. Oh, it was fantastic. I'll tell you, the way it went. About three or four days before the parade was ready to go, the police would be already out. They would be running, you know, the dry runs with the clubs. They would be practicing on fire hydrants and stuff. They're just hitting them. And they would be, the motorcycles would be all tuned up. You'd hear those mufflers roaring. And about three or four days before the parade. Now, my father was an insane union man. He was a real, real union nut. And he belonged to the union which later became Hoffa's Union. It was the Teamsters Local. And that there was never, ever, I don't know whether you know the history of the Teamsters Locals, the Teamsters Union, there's never, ever been a tougher union, as far as I know, outside of perhaps the dock workers, something like that. But the Teamsters Locals were the toughest locals in all the locals. And it was like playing for the Green Bay Packers. My father would always be proud to march with the Teamsters because he was marching with the toughest team in the entire line of march. And these guys didn't really march. They sort of stalked. Yeah, they did. They would stalk down the street with their eyes glaring, and they would grow beards for about 3 or 4 days before the parade. They did not wear their white shirts in that, you know. That wasn't the idea of the parade. It's funny how the parade has come to be sort of a little, you know, hanky-panky, whoopee thing. But the parade was to show that labor was together, and it was not fooling around with anybody. That was the whole idea of the parade in that time. And so my father would, about 3 or 4 days before the parade, he would stop shaving. And he would get himself a rotten, torn old blue shirt. And actually, he was a white-collar worker. You know, a lot of white-collar workers were in that union. And he would get himself a torn old blue shirt, and he would put on his old rotten overalls that he used to fix the Oldsmobile with, you know. And he would let his hair grow a little bit, and he'd get tough. And then the morning of the parade, there was more drinking. They would start drinking real early in the morning, you see. It was, cause it was gonna be, they would parade like 17 miles usually it was cold. Because around Chicago at this time of the year, it's already starting to get cold off that lake. And, they would start drinking because that was part of loosening up the inhibition so you could really hit guys. Cause generally speaking, during the year, these guys were, you know, they were like everybody else. They had a streak of kindness in them. But the idea of the drinking was to kill that streak of kindness. And they would start marching about 06. You know, it's a funny thing about how parades vary in America between cities. New York is a parade town, but New York is more of a formal parade town. They'll make a big announcement that the Puerto Ricans are going to march on next Saturday, or the Irish Americans are going to march, or something like that. And it's done very, very straight. You know, they have a little grandstand up there at 72nd Street, and they march down the street, and the traffic is stopped. Well, the Chicago parades are different. Chicago always prides itself, because Chicago is, as you know, is a second city, and it has a vague feeling that it's a second-rate city, and that gives it a lot of trouble. So, you know, that reminds, this is WOR, AM and FM, New York. And it makes them very much on the muscle. So when Chicago parades, it prides itself on having the biggest, longest parades. It will, really. The next day, invariably, the Chicago Tribune says, yesterday's parade was the longest parade in the history of parading. That was the longest parade. Since the Second Crusades, that was the longest parade. And, yes, they always do that. Every parade, every big parade, the Tribune applauds. Chicago once again did it. Of course, they do not say, except on page 28, that 37 skulls were broken. 18 streetcars were burned up. 14 windows were broken along State Street in Marshall Fields and Carson Peary. 74 police are in the hospital now. 9 horses were trampled to death. This is the kind of thing they did as parades. Well, the biggest parade of all was the Labor Day Parade, because it was a parade that was drafted. It was a drafted parade. And a lot of guys were mad because they were parading to begin with. And most guys were on the muscle because of the fact that the union, there was a two-pronged kind of fight going on. I wonder how many of you grew up in a home that was torn by union ideological yelling. Well, oh yes, oh, nobody ever mentioned religion. It was always the local. And it was the same kind of feeling that people have about their religion, that it's a thing that they absolutely believe in completely, and they're also afraid of it. It's in between, you know, like many a good religious person. He loves his religion, but he's also afraid a giant lightning bolt is going to hit him. That's going to be sent by that religion, you know. They're going to send it right down there and hit him. Well, that's exactly the feeling, in a way, that many of these guys had about their union locals. They were, the local was their team. It was their, it was fighting against management. It was fighting against all the things which they either fancied or were real as far as injustices were concerned. But more than that, it seemed to be fighting against all other locals. Now, this is something that nobody seems to be, you know, talk much about. But, in a steel mill town, the argument over jurisdiction between one union and another, one local and another, really, it makes our present racial conflicts look like greasy kid stuff, I'll tell you. I can remember many's the time at 3 o'clock in the morning, the sound of gunfire out in front, when a whole bunch of guys going to work on the shift were being fired on by the bunch of guys who had just come off shift. And they belonged to a different, they belonged to a different local. It was nothing, it was not uncommon for guys to carry guns in their lunchbox. And, they were continually being armed. They were always arming themselves with pieces of lead pipe, pieces of rubber hose. And I can remember particularly the great battles that they had around Chicago. There were two great battles that raged that, I wonder when the historians are going to write up these giant battles of mankind. The two great battles that raged, one of them was the Teamsters Union involving all of the dairies around there. Of course, my father worked for a dairy, and it was almost a daily occurrence where a man would be stopped, a guy in his truck somewhere out in a lonely road, and his truck would be burned up. They'd just blast his truck right off the street with shotguns and machine guns, and they would take him out, and he would wind up in the river because he said he didn't want to join the union, something like that, or he didn't believe in it. And this was continually. And, of course, then his friends would get together, and there would be a big battle then against the guys who they believed had done it. And so about 4 o'clock, about 3 or 4 days later in the morning, some guy's truck would be stopped. He was, of course, they all worked together. That's the interesting thing about it. They all knew each other, and they were all working together in a very rough amalgamation of workers. So about 3 or 4 days later, the guy who they thought had done it would be stopped by the guys who were the friends of the guy who had disappeared in the first place, and there would be more gunfire. And it would start again all over. You could hear it all over town sometimes. And, of course, my father was always coming home with these giant tales of the organization, organizing. So it was a real wild scene. And then it would all come to a head, an enormous head. I think I told the story one time when I was working in the steel mill. I was just a kid, and I think I was about 16. I had just got my working papers, and it was this summer. It was a summertime. And they were having a gigantic thing going on about the union. I never quite understood what the steel mill unions were all about, except that I had to join. I knew that. But at the time, I was not a member of the union because I was working for the main office, which was considered at that time an executive job. The mailboy. I was an executive. And, white-collar worker did not belong to the union, and they didn't want these guys in the union for some reason or other. And so there was a gigantic checkout going, and a strike, and everything else was going on at the same time. And one day, I had just gotten my driver's license. And I remember this vividly because it was one of the first wild things that ever happened to me in a car. And I was driving into the mill. Now, the mill is like, it's hard to describe a steel mill unless you have seen one. You just, and then you don't have to describe it. But a steel mill is like a big city. It really is. It's like a big, insane, madhouse, violent city behind high gates. You cannot just walk into a steel mill. A steel mill is not like any other, most other places of work where they have buildings and you can just walk. If you're a civilian, just walk over there. A steel mill is very tightly guarded because it's so dangerous. And it is almost impossible to get into a steel mill without... Well, you can, as far as I know. They have high gates, high walls all around the steel mill. And once you're inside, you're inside. But when you're outside, you're really outside. And you go through the clockhouse. The clockhouse being the place where you sign in. Well, actually, you don't sign in. You punch your clock, your card, and you go on through. And it's an enormous thing. And you can imagine what kind of madhouse it is when 13,000 guys are going through the clockhouse in about 5 minutes. And 13,000 guys, of course, are going out, too, of the other side of the clockhouse. Sometimes as high as 20,000 people are going through this one gate. Well, it's madhouse. Well, outside of the gate, they used to have what they called the checkout system, or the check system, or the dues checking system. There were numerous names for it, most of which I cannot tell you on the air. They were wild. And they would have a select committee of tough guys would stand outside and would check all the guys on this day to see whether their cards were all paid up. And if they weren't paid up, out. I mean, you just didn't go in, that's all, until you forked over. Then you got in. Now, other than that, when they were having a strike, the strike, you see, was very different from the kind of strike that you see walking around, you know, where somebody out in front of some nightclub, some guy's got a thing unfair to the bus boys or something like that, and they walk around with a sign. Oh, no. Oh, no. These were tough guys, and there were thousands of them. Many of them were the sons, and some of them were even the first generation immigrants. It was hard to communicate with a lot of them because they didn't speak English, and many of them came from violent backgrounds that go all the way. I don't know whether you've ever faced a raging horde of Kentucky hillbillies when they are on the rampage on a Saturday night. You know something about violence. And so a lot of those people worked in the mill, and they looked for a chance at violence and enjoyed it. They enjoyed it just the way other people enjoy bowling or going to the ball game. And so whenever there was a chance for violence, all the guys who dug violence, per se, as an art form, were out. And there were plenty of them around a steel mill, let me tell you. And so you would see when there was a strike, it didn't make a difference what the strike was. If somebody got mad at somebody else in the electrical shop, a lot of guys loved the idea of striking because it meant that there would be some fistfights. And fistfights were fun. And the more fun in the world, the better. You know, it was just kind of thing like that. It clears the atmosphere, you know, blackens a lot of guys' eyes, busts some skulls. But it's fun. So you'd be surprised how quick a lot of guys were to strike just for the violence in itself. They never said that. But it was always evident that it was there. What a strike! Oh, we go! We're going to fight them! We'll hit them, guys! Would be the first thing you'd hear in the Union Hall. And nobody, they wouldn't even argue what the strike was about. I remember one day, I'm sitting in the Union Hall. I'm a kid. I'm about 16, you know. And everybody had to go to the Union Hall. It was a strike vote. Well, a guy got up and the first thing he did, one of the heads of the union, nobody ever quite knew who they were. They were always there. They were running it. And they were tough, boy. They were left over from Al Capone and everything else. So one of those guys gets up and he says, "All right, men, we're going to vote and what do we strike? Are we going to go out?" Well, with that, you know, I'm sitting there. They hadn't said anything about what it was about or anything. And I'm a kid, you know, and I've been going through civics classes and all that stuff up to this point. And all of a sudden, all around me, about 14,000 blast furnace guys jumped up. Whole bunch of guys from the slag heap. But you go, boy, and, "Oh, we're gonna hit them, guys! Let's go! Let's go!" Well, within 5 seconds, the hall is emptied. We have voted. And, everybody is out across the street at this place where they serve, well, it came in kegs that were asbestos lined. It was not drinking stuff like you know. And this stuff came and it was sort of a smoldering green color. And it was called bourbon. And they always claimed it's the real Kentucky stuff. Is the way they would say it. Well, they would line these stuff, they right outside the Union Hall, they would have two or three of these joints that would serve the guys after the union meeting. Well, serve is a ridiculous word. What they did, they had big wooden planks set up on sawhorses over there. And on top of the planks, they had about 5,000 triple shots of this bourbon stuff that was green. And next to it, they had a big jug of water, if you were that kind. Well, what would happen with all these guys, the instant the strike vote would be taken, they would go tearing across the street, thousands of guys, you know, sweaty, smelling grease and oil and trailing dirt and stuff and yelling and hollering and blah, 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 blah. They go into this joint and they start throwing these things down. Boom! You know, they knock them down. They were 50 cents a glass, I remember. It was a big glass. And in about 10 minutes, Daddy, you had a strike like you never thought in your life would exist. Then they would go down the street. A great crowd of guys would go milling down the street, thousands of them, and they would stand in front of the mill, and they would start chanting and hollering into the mill. You see, now they're on strike, and they would holler, "Strike! Come on out, you guys! Rip up, you one! Come on!" Well, the guys they're yelling at are just the guys that are in there working, you know, and or else the foreman or anybody else, you know. It got to the point where foreman and everybody just had to sleep in there with tin hats on their head. So they're hollering, "Well, come on out, Atlanta!" And once in a while, a guy would come out and try to make a break for it. Like his kid was having a baby or something, he had to get out, you know, and a guy would make a break for it, and he would be chased for block, this little 3/4-ton pickup truck, and they're rocking the truck back and forth. and I am scared you know whatless. I am sitting in there, I am really scared, and the mail is falling off the walls. They had these little sacks of mail hanging in there, and we had a mail, a little mailbox where the little pigeon holes, you know, and all the mail is falling, and I can hear the gasoline slashing in the truck, and these guys are rocking back and forth, and they're hollering, scab, scab! And with that, the truck goes right over on its side. Crash! Down it goes. And I am sitting on the door now, you see. And they're all over, and they're hitting the truck. Guys are hitting the truck. You can hear banging with the wrenches and stuff, and they're yelling and screaming, and the mob is hollering. And suddenly, from the back of the truck, I smell smoke. Somebody has started the truck on fire. All the gas poured out, and someone has thrown a thing in it, and she is burning. Well, there I am, and it's burning like mad, and I kick the windshield open. I just kick it open, and there I'm looking at my truck, you know. It was a brand new truck, it was a pride and joy of the mailroom, and I kick the door open, and I kick the windshield out, and I'm crawling out over the hood, and these guys are grabbing me. They are grabbing me, and they're yelling and hollering, scab, scab, a scab worker, and they're grabbing me, and back and forth I go, and must have been about 1,000, and the poor old truck is burning up, and suddenly the guys got afraid of it. The truck is burning. They're afraid it's going to blow up. So they start, a great crowd starts to run away from the truck. Get away! Get away! Come on, you scab! And they grab me, and I am crying and weeping and yelling. The truck is burning up. And somebody, some cool head in the crowd, realized that this kid, this skinny 16-year-old kid, obviously was not a scab going in to work, to run the open hearth, you know. I wasn't going to go in to take over the blast furnace. Somebody says, he's a mail boy! He's just a mail boy! And they grabbed me, and I had my little green pin that says mail boy, you know. And they just suddenly realized it, and they throw me to the ground, and they turn, and they go back to the clock house without so much as a backward glance. And I'm on the ground, and my truck is burning up. And with that, I can hear in the distance all these sirens coming. Somebody has called the police. Someone's called the fire department. And the sirens are coming. The cops are all around. And then it started again. Fuzz, you cop finks, rat finks. And they're hollering and fist fighting. And I'm all in the middle of it. And I'm trying to crawl back to the mail room. You know, all the way back on my hands and knees, my truck burning in the distance. Oh, boy. I get back to the mail room. And, of course, by that time, somebody has called up the mail department and said one of the boys is really in trouble. Well, I remember Arnold, the man who worked in the department was named Moss, Arnold Moss, the same as the actor. Every time I hear the name Arnold Moss, I think of him. Well, I worked for Arnold Moss for a long time, and I never once saw him without his hat. You could always tell an official guy in the mill, he always wore his hat. Executives wore a fedora, and workers wore worker-type hats. And he's got this hat on, and I come in there, and I'm screaming and hollering, I'm out of my skull, and I say to him, the truck, they're burning the truck up! He says, I know, just take it easy now, that's all right, just take it easy, we can get another truck. Now take it easy. And I'm scared, I figure I've had it, I'm gonna get fired now. My truck is burned up, I didn't get the mail in, the mail is burning up, everything is burning up, you know. And I'm sitting there, and he says, now just take it easy, just, and I can hear him outside, you can hear him about a block away, hollering, scab, and the strike continued. Well, this was just one incident, and I remember, of course, so naturally in a town like this, feelings ran very high about unions, pro, con, indifferent, everything else, and the feelings were a very subtle kind of feeling too. Because everybody you see did work. That's the thing you have to understand. Nobody was anti-union. A lot of guys just were anti getting their heads split open, which was constantly happening around there. Just a continual situation. Well, on Labor Day then, which was the big day, this all would come to a head. Now, this is what I meant about Labor Day. They never had a Miss Plumbers local, as far as I know, in that parade. If they did, she was made out of stainless steel. That's all I got to say about that. But all of these unions would march, and the police would be out. And I remember, right after all of this stuff had happened, the steel workers were marching, and the iron workers were marching, and everybody was marching, and they had told us at the union meeting the day before, they had a big meeting the night before about the big parade, see, and they said that there's liable to be trouble. There's liable to be trouble. And you got to be ready for trouble. Well, of course, the implication always was it was going to be management that was going to give you trouble. Well, just like most of those things, it never comes from management at all. It came from the other guys, the other locals, you see. But that's what they really meant. And nobody would ever admit that the trouble came from anybody else but rotten management. And if one local was charging another local with flamethrowers, rotten management, put them up to it. Let's get after that management. And they would go like that. There was a strange kind of peculiar double talk that went on like that. And so I remember on this one and the only Labor Day parade that I ever was involved in as a parader, I was drafted. The first thing they did was to say, all the guys that are not married, who do not have any kids, gotta march. Well, all right, that was that. So that took care of a lot of guys right then. Then they said, all guys over 6'7" are gonna march. Well, that took another whole bunch of guys from the open heart and the blast furnace. All guys that weigh over 300 pounds and eat cabbage and can't speak nothing are going to march. Well, that included a whole lot of other guys. Well, before the meeting was over, they had a phalanx that would make the Roman legions look like a Boy Scout troop from Passaic. I'll tell you, it was a phalanx. And it was truly a phalanx. And they told us how we were going to march. And they said, well, there's always going to be some wise guy. I don't know who's making up the line of march, but let me tell you this. There's always some wise guy, so bet get ready for them plumbers. Well, so that's what happened. That day, the march was set up, and some of the groups had bands. And it all started out about 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning, fairly peaceful. And we started to march, and there were thousands of people. Chicago is a natural-born parade-going city. Chicago loves parades. Loves them, literally loves them. Nobody ever yells about parades there. They love a parade. So there are millions of people out there. Now, the reason they were out there, well, there were two reasons. One of them was that many of them were union members, you see, waiting for the trouble to start, and they can pitch in with their gang. The other was people who just like fighting. They like to watch fighting, you see. Oh, yeah, they like to watch fighting. So, you know, it's just the way it is. And then there were a lot of innocent bystanders who, you know, there's a parade in Chicago on Labor Day, and they all come with the kids, and they stand around and eat Good Humor bars. Now, that's the crowd that was always getting in the way of the swingers. That crowd is hated by both sides. You know, they're always getting in the middle of a big pitched battle. Some guy's going along with three kids, you know, and some ice cream bars. And he's in the middle of the battle between the Steelworkers Structural Union and the Teamsters Local. And they're pitching it at each other. Well, we started out, it's about 8 o'clock in the morning. And everybody is lining. And it was one of those typical gusty, cold, early fall Chicago days. When there's little touches of rain in the air and you could feel it, it's a little cool, and it's just the kind of weather that brings a man to his full fighting force, you know? It's good football weather. It really makes a guy ready to swing. And so we're out there in the morning, it's about 8, 9 o'clock, and they come along with this scalding hot coffee, which the steel workers had provided for the troops. We were the troops. And they came along with this black coffee into which most of the guys from the blast furnace put their blast furnace juice. Because they always said it was awful cold. And they start putting this stuff in there, and about 8:30, that's breakfast too, after they have had 9 fried eggs at home, you know, and a half a pound of bread. So they're ready to go. And about 8:30 or 8:45, these guys are all lined up, and I'm in the middle of them all. And about half of them are on the muscle, just ready to fight. The other half are bagged and are already fighting each other. And oh boy, I'll tell you. Well, I was not a little kid, you see. I was a pretty big kid. And so I could handle my own too. I'm pushing and hollering along with the rest. And about 9 o'clock, they don't march in step or anything like that. Remember this. This is just a great big snake dance all through Chicago. Somebody blows a whistle and yells, "Kyle, guys, get moving!" Somebody behind us, you know, somebody from the structural steel workers, and somebody turns, blow it off! Well, you know, that's the way it started, like that. Who are you talking to? And the next thing you know, the two captains are belting it out, but we're moving. So we start moving down State Street. Well, the wind is getting colder, and it's getting gusty. And one band is about 9 miles ahead of us, and this band is playing something like Semper Fidelis. And another band behind us is playing like the National Emblem March. And these two bands are going along playing two different marches. And the band in between, this is an actual true story, the band in between, which was the plumbers or the electrical workers, cannot get going. Because of the two bands. Have you ever marched and the bands are always lousing each other up? Well, this band here, up ahead of us, starts to yell at the band ahead of it. And the band ahead of us is yelling at the band behind us. Everyone's, let's get together here! Well, roughly about, I would say, about 12th Street and State, about 12th and State, it began to break out. People began to yell at the crowd on the side, and guys from the crowd began to throw eggs at the steel workers. A very bad tactical error. Because not only do steel workers, well, they enjoy, that's the thing that you gotta understand. So an egg sailed out, went right past me, and hit a melter. Well, this guy turned around, and he says, what are you doing, wise guy? And he turns like that, and about five guys from the chipping dock turn. And you could see about seven guys in the crowd throwing eggs. They're pelting eggs. Well, I forget the parade. They just cut right out, and they're in the crowd. You can see the crowd is fighting it out now. And we're slowly moving downtown as we go. You know, this is, you got to understand. And with that, somebody on the other side of the street throws a beer bottle in. A beer bottle comes sailing in. This is a Teamsters local. And you could hear one of the guys out, oh, that damn Teamsters! And you, like that. The word Teamsters was enough to make the steel workers go out of their skull. Just Teamsters. That's it. It's just Teamsters. Over they go. And there's about another fist fight now is going on the other side with about 25 guys. The police are coming up the street. The police are coming. And we are still slowly moving downtown. And the band is playing Semper Fidelis. And we are moving. With that, we keep going, and the crowd ahead of us, which was, I think, the structural steel workers. By the way, that was another tough union, as you can tell, just by the name of what they did. And they were always having trouble with the steel workers, which was another kind of local, you see. And you can see when the little jurisdictional disputes overlap, structural steel work, you can see it already, you know. Well, this crowd was kind of slowing up there, and they were waiting. Apparently, you know how these parades, without any warning, they'll stop? Well, the steel workers ran into the structural workers. And there was a lot of yelling. Quit your shoving, Mac! Come on, shut up, will ya? Hey, I can't go there up there. They're stopped up ahead. Oh, get out. With that, there was a fight that started out between the structural steel workers and the steel workers. They began to slug it out. Well, I am in the middle. Have you ever been in a genuine gang fight, the kind that you see in the movies? The kind, you know, that John Wayne is always having. Remember with Wayne Morris, those guys are always having the big gang fight. Well, this gang fight started about 9 o'clock, 9:30 in the morning. The parade had just started out. They started to slug it out, and for over 2.5 blocks, right in the heart of Chicago, there is a fist fight that must have numbered at least 25,000 participants. They are slugging each other with everything they can grab their hands on. And you could hear windows breaking, people yelling and hollering. Of course, the crowd on the sideline love it. They're yelling and cheering, and they're getting into it. They're yelling and hollering. The cops are coming down and yelling, and they're hitting guys with the clubs, you know. And nobody is even paying any attention. After you've gotten hit by a crowbar four times, that little Billy, you know, is nothing. And they're hitting each other with crowbars and yelling and hollering. And you could hear coming from the far distance, you could hear the riot squad. And the sirens are coming. And we are still fighting it out. By 10:30, the fight has spread now, and it is over 4 blocks long. And then the fire department arrived with the hoses in the cold weather. And they are squirting all the workers assembled. All the workers. And there were big signs, you know, stuff like, solidarity of the labor movement. You know, that kind of stuff. Workers march together to full unionization. Workers united. And I remember our union had as its symbol a great big clasped hand. Two hands clasped. One said management, one said labor, you know, and under it said local 1010. And the guys were holding the sign up, hitting the guys in front with it, you know, popping them with the sign. And they're screaming and hollering. Well, about 12:30, I arrived back home. Wet to the skin. My shirt torn right off my back. A scratch that I still bear, by the way, the scar of. I still have a scar on my right hand from it. And my mother says, I heard about the parade on the radio. How was the parade? I said, it was the greatest parade Ma ever saw. The most fantastic parade. I can hardly wait for next year. Hardly wait for the next one.
Gene Shepherd describes the passing parade further tomorrow night at 11:15 on WOR Radio.
And as usual, we've run way over our time. This has been the Dustman of History, Gene Shepherd, Labor Day, Chicago Labor Day Parade, September 2nd, 1963. Coming up next, Uncontrollable Opposition. I believe that's the duo. That's all I know. This is WBAI New York. Thanks for listening. Back next week on Sunday night, 8 to 10, the Golden Age of Radio.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal. Well, I'm going to go clean the bathroom.